This will be my last Beyond Texas podcast of 2023. There's a new movie out, roughly 10 years in the making, called The Boys in the Boat. It's directed by George Clooney. It's about a ragtag group of Depression-era American boys who, against hopeless odds, won a gold medal in rowing at Hitler's 1936 Olympics. When I saw the movie was finally coming out, I remembered discussing the idea of a film 10 years ago when I interviewed author Daniel Brown, who wrote the best-selling book on which the film is based. I was hosting a program then for NPR stations called Good Books Radio. I decided here that I would just play that original interview as a podcast in which Daniel Brown tells us how the book came about and why it was so special for him. Here's my interview from 10 years ago that has fresh relevance given Clooney's adaptation of the New York Times best-selling book, which is, once again, topping the publishing charts. Number 10 this week on Amazon, and number 2 on New York Times nonfiction list. Enjoy. Welcome to Good Books Radio. I'm your host today, Dr. W.F. Strong. We have a wonderful book today, Boys in the Boat by Daniel Brown. This was a bestseller earlier this year, number one on the New York Times, and it dominated that spot for several weeks, so I'm really delighted to have the chance to talk to him. It remains in the top 50 on Amazon right now. It is first in sports. It is first in sports history. So this book is loved by everybody who reads it. I consider it in that category of Unbroken by Hildebrand, a feel-good, spiritually rejuvenating kind of book. Before we get started, I want to, of course, thank our sponsor, Audiobooks.com, for underwriting the program. Audiobooks.com says that your first book is free. So try it out. Go there, audiobooks.com, and register, and your first book will be free, and you can listen to books to your heart's content. We have Daniel Brown on the phone now, so let's talk to him. Right. I was looking at Amazon and the record of your the reviews of your book by just regular people, and I noticed that there were 3,400 reviews, and 95% of them gave you 5 stars. For your book.
Isn't that something?
That is amazing. Yeah. You get an A-plus from 3,500 people. That is really rare. I mean, I've studied these things a lot, and nobody gets that kind of rating. What do you think is the magic?
You know, actually, I think this is kind of interesting book for me, and it's really turned into a word-of-mouth book. I mean, this is a book that we never had like a New York Times review or a Today Show interview or anything like that that often propels books onto the New York Times list. But it's one of those books that just people seem to, they read it and then they like it. And so they talk to their family about it and they suggest it in their book groups. And I can tell by the feedback and the email I get and also all those Amazon reviews that it's mostly just people liking the core of the story and wanting to share it with other people, which is great. I mean, it's the kind of book I want to write. So I'm really pleased by that.
Well, it certainly takes you through all the levels of emotion. I mean, you know, you have, as a reader, you have great joy, you have great sadness. You pull us right along with the characters there. And I felt just horrible for Joe. Why in the world did his family abandon him like that?
Isn't it incredible? I mean, his family abandoned him when he was a teenager and left him literally to forage for food in the woods out on the Olympic Peninsula. And it's hard to fathom how parents could do something like that. Although, you know, this was the middle of the Great Depression, and it wasn't entirely uncommon for families to go off and leave teenage kids behind and leave them to themselves because they had younger kids whose mouths they had to put food into. So it was a really tough time for Joe. And a lot of the story, of course, is about his overcoming that adversity and finding value in himself. And a large part of that was through his participation in this this rowing crew that turned out to be, you know, to go all the way to the Olympics.
Well, that was the other thing I found remarkable, is that he's trying to keep his life together, just trying to eat, and he's managing to go to school and managing to push himself forward despite all of these setbacks that I think most people would have found themselves giving up on the school thing just to survive.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was really part of his DNA, part of his character. He was, even when I knew him as a very old man, he was a and he was dying when I knew him. Mm. He was a remarkably positive, forward-looking guy. And actually, a lot of these guys, most of these guys, if not all of them in this boat, had that same characteristic. They really, they were about moving forward. They weren't really about dwelling on the past and things, bad things that had happened to them. In fact, that's part, I think, of why they became such a successful crew. They had a very optimistic view of the world, even in very, very dark times.
So would you say that these boys who created this gold medal winning team at the Olympics were exceptional in the fact that they made an exceptional team, that they weren't individually extraordinarily talented, but they came together in an extraordinary way?
Yes, I think that was key. Crew is a sport that requires an extraordinary amount of cooperation and teamsmanship, and really requires you, when you climb in the boat, to sort of leave your ego on the dock and become part of something bigger than yourself. And really great crews are crews that are comprised entirely of individuals who have that attitude, who are pulling, not, you know, not just for themselves, and they're not trying to get the boat across the line all by themselves. They're part of this bigger thing. And as a result, they become very close emotionally. And these nine young men I'm talking about, part of what's remarkable about their story is that they remained bonded together after this this extraordinary event in Berlin in 36. They remained bonded together literally for the rest of their lives. When there were only two of them left, Joe Rance and Roger Morris, the two of them would get on the phone and sit for, gosh, an hour at a time and hardly say two words. But they just needed to be together, you know. So that was actually really moving for me to see.
So Joe had quite a struggle because he was abandoned by his real family, and he learned to pull himself up by his own bootstraps, but then he got onto the crew team and had to surrender to the team. I mean, that must have been difficult for him.
Yeah, I mean, that was the core of his problem, you know, when it came to crew, was that for a number of years he could only depend on himself. He really only trusted himself, and he learned to make his way in the world all by himself, which was a source of strength for him, of course. But then when he climbed in a boat, he discovered that rowing's very different, that it's not all about you, and that you can't do it yourself, and that you have to become part of this larger thing. You have to learn to trust other people and work with other people, even some of them aren't perhaps your favorite people in the world. And so it was a very big transformation for Joe. In the first couple of years he was rowing, he had our time with that, and it was really only in the spring of 1936 that he made this sort of mental breakthrough with the help of George Pocock, this sort of sage-like boat builder who was part of the story, that he realized what he had to do, that he had to become, let go of some of his ego and become part of this other bigger thing.
Well, this has movie written all over it. Is there a movie deal in the works?
Yeah, actually there is. The Weinstein Company, which that's the outfit that made The King's Speech, a number of other Oscar-winning films, they optioned the film several years ago, and then they went ahead and bought the rights to the movie, to the adaptation, about a year and a half ago. So they are, last I heard, they're working on a script, and you never know with Hollywood.
But, yeah.
But it's looking good right now. So
no, but I mean, it has all the elements, you know, the Rocky story in a way, you know, the kids that are down and out and are made extraordinary through personal effort and through the sage-like advice of the old man and the coach. And it has a beautiful feel-good story, and it's real, and that's the thing that makes it special.
That's the beauty of it. It all really happened. And so, yeah, you know, if they just, it's up to them to make whatever kind of movie they want. But I think if they just stick to the basic facts of the story, it's all there for them. So,
I'm
hopeful.
How did you come across this?
This story, I mean, it literally walked into my living room one day about 6 years ago. My neighbor, a lady I knew then only as Judy, came to me and came to the house, and she said she was reading one of my earlier books to her dad. And her dad was actually in the last couple months of his life living in hospice care at her home. And she'd been reading this book to him, and she wondered if he was liking it. So she wondered if I would come down and meet him. So I think it was the next day I went down and I met this elderly gentleman, Joe Rance. And he was weak. He was on oxygen, but he was very alert mentally. And we talked just for a minute about that earlier book. But then he started talking about his experience growing up during the Depression and this abandonment and what that felt like and what that meant to him and how, you know, ultimately Crew had started to sort of redeem his life and how he and his crewmates had wound up rowing for gold medal in Berlin against a Nazi boat in front of Hitler. And
wow.
Boy, you know, I just felt, my jaw was dropped by the time he was done. And actually, it was kind of interesting because at the end of that conversation, I hadn't gone down there looking for a book topic, but mm-hmm. I was just blown away. So I had just immediately, I said, Joe, can I write a book about your life? And mm-hmm. and he shook his head and he looked down at the floor and he said, no, I don't want you to write a book about me. But then he looked up and he had tears in his eyes mm-hmm. and he said, but you could write a book about the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I didn't know what he meant. I thought he meant this beautiful cedar shell, this racing shell. But then it dawned on me as he talked a little more, what he meant by the boat was, of course, the other boys in the boat, the crew, and even more than that, this sort of, perfect, almost perfect thing that they had all become together and done mm-hmm. together. You know, that summer in Berlin. And so that's the, you know, that's the spirit I set out to write the book, to try to make, it was important to Joe it not be about him or any one mm-hmm. individual, but that it be about all of them together. So that's what I set out to do starting the next day.
What did you learn about Hitler's time? You went over there and found what you could about that period of time. What did you learn about Hitler and those Olympic Games?
Yeah, you know, I think like a lot of us, I knew the story of Germany pretty much from the beginning of the war on. I mean, I knew, of course, about the war and the Holocaust and all that, but I didn't know a great deal about Germany in the mid-1930s from the time that Hitler took over leading up to the war. And it was really an eye-opening experience for me because I immersed myself in German history and read an enormous amount. And I was just stunned by how cynical the effort was on the part of the Nazis to use the 1936 Olympics as an enormous propaganda tool. I mean, they literally turned Berlin into a movie set. They scrubbed the streets. They rounded up all the gypsies and homeless people in Berlin and sent them away to their fate. They created sort of a magical alternate version of Germany that was meant to conceal what was really happening. Mm-hmm. Because at the same time as this was happening, they were building Dachau that summer. So it was eye-opening to me to realize the extent to which they went to use the Olympics as a propaganda tool. And I have to say, it was actually very effective. Most of the Americans who went to Berlin that summer came back thinking Germany was a modern, well-run, clean, almost model society.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, people changed their minds within a few years.
Yes.
Yeah, but the initial effort was very successful in sort of concealing what was really happening.
I was wondering if you do any speaking to corporations about team building.
You know, it surprised me a great deal. It never dawned on me when I was writing this book, but yeah, shortly after it came out, I've been approached by a number of corporate and other large entities who want me to, and I have been going to talk to them about this story and how it pertains to building teams in, you know, whatever kind of context, including corporate contexts.
What do you teach in those seminars? What do you stress?
Well, you know, it's really, there's a series of things that go together. But the most important thing, I think, has to do with the most important thing in the story, which was and is building trust. You can't have a successful team of any kind, really, on any permanent, continuing basis if the players don't trust each other. And the more they trust each other, there's almost a direct correlation with how well they will do as a team if you can measure the trust they have for one another. So that's the thing I wind up stressing the most.
And how did the coach build that trust?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. There were really basically two forces at work on these kids for the 3 years that they were coming together as this great team. One was George Pocock, this boat builder, who was almost a mystical kind of figure, a sage-like figure. And he was also a very good oarsman. So he coached the boys a lot, even though he was, you know, formerly a boat builder. He actually spent a long time coaching the boys. And he's the one that taught them about trust and letting go of the ego and pulling for the other guy as much as you're pulling for yourself. The coach was also very important. Al Ulbrichtsen was a very different kind of guy, though. He was a very hard man and a cold man in many ways. He was very reticent. He didn't like to display emotion, and a lot of the boys were frankly pretty scared of him. Mm-hmm. But he put them through their paces, and he got a lot of performance out of them. And he also was very good at finding the right combination. A lot of the trick to success in crew is mixing and matching both physical types and personality types. It isn't really a coaching. A prominent rowing coach just recently told me he would never take the eight strongest men or women he would never take the strongest man or woman in a boat and ask for eight clones of that man or woman, because mm-hmm. that's not the way crew works. You need a sort of diversity of strengths and personality types to make a really successful crew. So Ulbrichtsen, the coach of this particular group, was very good at that. He was good at finding the sort of alchemy, the sort of magical combination of personality types and physical types, and putting them in the right seats of the boat until he got a boat that really, really took off on a level he thought could compete on an Olympic level.
Now, you were able to, obviously, you were interviewing Joe at the latter part of his life. And how many hours would you say you got to spend with him?
Whoa. Well, Joe was for about another 2.5 months. And, of course, he was weak, so I wanted to pace things. I spent dozens of hours with Joe, mm-hmm. but not hundreds, because that just would have been too much for him.
Right.
The thing that saved the day in terms of getting Joe's story done was that his daughter Judy had spent, particularly the last 5 years or so of her dad's life, she had literally followed him around with a pad of paper and a pencil and prodded him for memories and details about this or that, about his growing up in the Depression and his experience on this crew. So even after Joe died, Judy and I had this enormous treasure trove of material to work with in terms of developing his life. And that's one reason he's sort of at the center of the story.
Were you able to talk to the coaches at all? Or were they? I imagine they were too old, right?
Yeah, no, they were gone. Mm-hmm. But I was able to talk to, and this was also very important, the family members of the other eight guys in the boat. Uh-huh. This family's been sitting on this story for 75 years, hoping somebody would tell it. So they were very excited, and they supplied an enormous amount of information for me.
Did his daughter come to get you with the idea that maybe you would do it?
You know, I didn't know that when she came up here that day. I had no idea. But she had been reading this earlier book to her dad, and they were both really liking it. So that's the reason she'd been taking these notes for all these years. She had been trying to find a writer, and I just happened to have moved into the neighborhood a year or so before that. And then when she read that earlier book, she got this idea in her head. So she kind of lured me down there. I had no idea. But it didn't take long. I mean, one session sitting down with Joe, and I was raring to go.
Well, when did you discover that you liked to write?
Oh, gosh. You know, I literally, when I was a kindergarten kid, I remember lying on the floor in a pool of sunlight with a box of crayons and a piece of paper writing a book about dinosaurs. And I still remember that moment. I've loved books all my life. I was an English major in college. I taught English at the college level afterwards. I had to go out in the corporate world to make a living for quite a few years, but I was a writer and an editor there too. And
yeah, I saw that you went into technical writing. How in the world do you do that after you do this beautiful, it's nonfiction, but it's creative nonfiction. So how do you do technical writing? I would die.
Well, you do what you have to do to make a living. The technical writing part actually came before most of this other writing, and I learned actually a lot about it. I mean, I learned some valuable things as a writer, being a technical writer. It's all about precision and conciseness and clarity. And so those things are still useful when you're writing a narrative that has a lot of emotional content too. So,
well, what sort of technical writing did you do, and how to put a tent together?
I was working in software industry, basically users' manuals and help systems and tutorials online and that kind of thing, designed to tell users how to use the software. It was not a burning passion.
Yes, I'm sure. But it kept the lights on.
It kept the lights on, and it worked out well in the long run.
Well, and I'm sure it gave you a kind of extraordinary joy when you could cut loose from that and write what you really wanted to write.
Yeah, exactly. I got to a place in my life where I had a little space and started writing the first book just without a contract or anything. I wrote the whole book just to see if I could do it. And then just fortunately, and to my amazement, a publisher picked it up and published it. And then things took off from there. It won a prize, and a bigger publisher bought the paperback rights, and things just took off from there. So I was lucky, but I also worked really hard to get there. So,
well, this book, The Boys in the Boat, has been an extraordinary bestseller. I mean, it's New York Times bestseller, and I looked up last night just to see that it was number 44 on Amazon out of all books on Amazon. It's number 44 rating. I mean, that's, what do they have, 6 million books and you're number 44? that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's very cool. So what's next? Have you another story you found?
You know, I'm looking. One of these books, because my books are so research intensive that it takes me at least 4 and maybe 5 years to do one. That's a big chunk of my life, and so I want whatever it is to be a story I really love, and a story I think can compete with this one in terms of just how good a story it is. So that's a tall order, and I'm just sort of taking my time right now. I've got some stories to think about, but none of them have really clicked with me yet. So I'm gonna wait until just the right story comes along, and then pounce on it.
But isn't it really less about the story in its objective sense and more about how you breathe life into it? For instance, when I read the title of this and read basically what it was about, I thought, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then as I got into it, you know, you brought it to life.
Yeah, you know, that's an important point I should just make. If I hear all the time in Amazon reviews and on emails, people say, I almost didn't read your book because I thought it was about rowing, and really, what could be more boring than a book about rowing? And then, unfortunately, they go on to say, wow, I was wrong. It was about so much more than rowing, so it's kind of a hurdle the book has to get over. I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think, you can, a good writer should be able to breathe a lot of life into any story, but it really helps to have a really great story to start with.
Well, I mean, clearly the more you dug into it, the more there was to bring to life, right?
Yeah. And you know, you're never sure of that when you start. I mean, when I started this, I knew Joe was a great guy and had a great story, but I wasn't sure the other eight guys, they could have been eight jerks for all I knew. I was just very fortunate that they all turned out to be really, really great young men with really interesting stories and a lot of character. And so that was, that was a big relief and very helpful.
You know, as I was reading your book and the extraordinary discipline that the coach required, it reminded me of Oscar Wilde's story about, you know, people were, when he was working as an editor of a magazine there in London, and people were, you know, more or less telling him he was a sissy boy. And he said, well, I'll have you know that when I was at Oxford, I was on the rowing team. And he said that he lasted 2 weeks because the upperclassmen kept yelling at him and telling him to sit up straight in the boat. And he told them that he doubted that the Greeks were worried about posture when they defeated the Persians at Salamis.
That is a great Oscar Wilde,
isn't it?
I'd never heard that.
Yes,
I love it.
He said, so I left the boat.
Yeah, many people have left the boat. You know, it is a really tough sport. I mean, I have to say, I had no idea when I started this, the demands. And the physical demands are extraordinary, but the mental demands are extraordinary too. It really takes a certain kind of a certain breed to do this, particularly at the Olympic level. I came away pretty awed by these guys, actually.
Well, I was particularly impressed with the way you described the pain that they had to put up with to row that distance, and most of it was a painful experience that they just had to tough it out.
Yeah, you know, and these, to this day, it's still a painful experience. And people that row are an interesting bunch. They put up with that. They do that in a sport where, particularly nowadays, there's no money, and there's very little glory involved. They do it just for the sheer love of it, and also for this incredible sort of camaraderie that grows up in a boat that really is. You know, that in itself is very rewarding to people that stick with it, I think.
Well, listen, we're out of time. I thank you so much for joining us today on Good Books Radio. It's been wonderful talking to you, and I enjoyed the book enormously. There's two books that are often mentioned in the same breath. It's Unbroken and The Boys in the Boat. And both of them, for me, in the last few years, when it comes to story about the human spirit conquering all, both of these books do that beautifully.
Well, thank you. That's quite a compliment to be compared with Unbroken. I'm a big fan of Laura Hillenbrand and both of her books, actually.
And both true stories, which always, to me, adds, makes them more meaningful, I think, because it's real.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's all we have time for today. We've been talking to Daniel Brown about his best-selling book, Boys in the Boat, a wonderful read. I cannot recommend it enough. You will absolutely love it. You will stay up all night to finish this book. For Good Books Radio and for audiobooks.com, I'm Dr. W.F. Strong, hoping that all your books are good reads.